From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine. His new book, Money and Class in America, is an examination of how we worship money and the people who have it. Also today, filmmaker John Waters does the mashed potatoes to sell his new film, Hairspray. It's a send-up of teen dance movies. This is part two of our interview with the director who gave us Pink Flamingos. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers Little Willie John, the late rhythm and blues singer who first recorded the pop classic Fever. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Trial of Socrates, I.F. Stone's version of what happened back in 399 BC. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Lewis Lapham is the editor of Harper's Magazine. In his new book, he writes, "I was born into the ranks of the equestrian class and educated to the protocols of wealth at prep school and college. Given the circumstances of my childhood, I don't know how I could have avoided an early acquaintance with the pathologies of wealth. The pathologies of the wealthy and of those obsessed with getting rich are the subjects of Lapham's new book, Money and Class in America." Money and class are subjects Lapham has also written about in his monthly Harper's column called Notebook. Lapham has had two tenures as editor of Harper's from 1976 to 81, then from 1983 to the present. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. His book is subtitled Observations on Our Civil Religion. I asked him in what ways he thought money had become our civil religion.
I think it's become a substitute for a number of other values, such as family or God or class or intellect. I mean, it's the doctrine of the bottom line. In other words, people establish their worth in the world and their relation to other people in terms of their cash assets.
Do you think this is true more so now than it used to be?
I think it comes and goes. I think in the American scheme of things, since the beginning in Calvinist New England, there's been two tendencies at work in the American enterprise. One of them is a spiritual one, and one of them is based on commerce and faith in the bottom line. And so I think it's more evident now, and it's more virulent now than it's been possibly since the last 20 years of the 19th century. I mean, it's like a second Gilded Age.
You start one of your chapters with an interesting quote from Ronald Reagan, and the quote is, "What I want to see above all is that this remains a country where someone can always get rich."
Right.
What I find interesting about that is that in Ronald Reagan's speeches, he doesn't really call attention to his own wealth, and we know that he's really quite wealthy, but what he does call attention to is his modest past, growing up in a working-class family, a hard-working father in a small town. And I just find that a very interesting contradiction.
Oh, I don't think so. It's a contradiction at all. I mean, that's a variation on the Horatio Alger story. In other words, a young man starts with nothing, comes west to California, finds a fortune, and so forth. That's a classical American adventure. I mean, the point is you start, no matter how humble your circumstances. I think that's what he means by his quotation. I mean, it's a country in which people can always get rich. What he means is people who are born poor can find a way to fame and fortune as in much the same way that he himself has done.
But, I mean, in a speech you wouldn't hear him talking about how he became rich or what he does with his money or how proud he is that he's rich.
No, but his entire manner conveys the sense of opulence. I mean, this is a man accustomed. He surrounds himself with Hollywood celebrities. His wife buys very expensive clothes. His friends are nouveau riche, arriviste automobile dealers, and they're all, you know, it's the whole feeling of the Reagan administration is like a golf course in Palm Springs. And he takes such pleasure in these things, and so that it's quite clear that he's comfortable with the opulent circumstances that fate has placed him.
You think that most people don't really understand what it is that money can or can't bring you.
Well, that's a very old theme. That's a Christian theme, right? I mean, the love of money is the source of all evil, says the Bible. Not money itself, but the attitude toward money and the expectation of what money can bring you. I mean, money clearly doesn't buy happiness. That is a very old story, not only an American one, but it's the story of Shakespeare's Timon of Athens. It's the story of it's the story of Midas. I think if you say to somebody, look, money doesn't buy you happiness, I think everybody in the United States would nod their heads and say, of course, you're absolutely right.
Well, we've all seen the movies where, gets really wealthy and it doesn't buy them the happiness they expected, and it actually leads to their downfall.
True. I mean, that's a very clear moral in the American tale.
Yeah, I always figured those movies exist to make us feel better that we're not wealthy.
that is one of the reasons that they exist, sure. I mean, it's comforting to know that there goes X or Y, you know, bathed in jewels or sitting at the back of a yacht and the poor man or woman is not happy.
Well, you talk about a friend who's making $250,000 a year, but is constantly feeling in desperate straits because it's just not nearly enough to keep the family in the lifestyle they're accustomed to.
Right. Well, that's a fairly characteristic American tale. I mean, if you go the personal debt today is, that's to say, the kind of credit card debt. And consumer debt, I'm not even talking about mortgages, is larger than the national deficit. It's enormous. I mean, there are a number of people in this country who are living beyond their means is a very large number. And they're doing so for reasons much like the friend that I cite in the book, because they're trying to maintain a level of appearance or a level it's a variation on keeping up with the Joneses. And we're doing it both at the private level and at the public level. We are bankrupting the country, in my view, to maintain a military establishment, which is a form of opulent display.
You discuss some of the differences between old money and new money, and you say that new money is more fun to be around. Would you explain?
Well, if you're with the whole story of America, of course, is the story of old money of new money becoming old money, and so forth and so on. It's a great comedy. It's a great joke, of course, because the new money revisited today. Somebody like, say, Donald Trump in New York is regarded by the old money, that is to say the money that's had the people that have had their money for one or two generations, look down their patrician noses at Mr. Trump and say that he is an arrivist and so forth, but is precisely the sort of thing that was being said about the Rockefeller family in the early years of the 20th century. So that is a constant theme. Now, the difference is that the people who have the reason that the new money is fun to be around is because they are likely to be people who have made it themselves as opposed to have inherited it, and therefore they're not as afraid of it. They having made a fortune, they know they can make another fortune, so that money becomes a kind of, they spend it far more freely than do the people who have inherited it. And therefore, they are fun to be around because they don't mind sending limousines across town at the middle of the night for a ham sandwich or a copy of Proust. They can enjoy it because it's real to them, and it's something they know they can replenish.
Louis Lapham is my guest. You also say that the old rich recognize each other by subtler clues than the nouveau rich.
Right. The nouveau riche tend to buy their forms of recognition and self-esteem. They buy the yacht, they buy the house in Palm Springs, they buy the $5,000 dress or the $20,000 watch or the $50,000 coat or whatever it is, and they recognize each other by the toys that they collect. You know, the old rich tend to recognize each other by the places that they've been brought up. I mean, they say, do you remember such and such a golf course, or do you remember what the light was like in Southampton or Greenwich, Connecticut, or Burlingame, California, when we were all 3 years old, and so forth. I mean, and by the schools that they've been to or the clubs to which they belong. I mean, they're like tokens and emblems of their achieved status in the society.
This is one I find especially interesting. You say that new money thinks that its money is as good as anyone else's money. But what? But the old rich know better?
Yeah, sure, the old rich know better. The old rich think that because they've had their money for two, three, four generations, they deserve, their money has somehow cleansed them of the original sin of either greed or crime on which the fortune has been based. And therefore, they think they've been sitting in this club for 30 years and that they are somehow more exalted than the newest arrival.
Lewis Lapham is my guest. He's the editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of a new book titled Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. Now, you're from a wealthy family yourself. Do you feel like something of a traitor writing about the wealthy and writing about the foibles of the wealthy?
No, not at all. It's an old American. A writer writes about what one knows. So you write about the world in which with which you're familiar. I would not know how to write about the world of the urban slum, and I therefore write out of my own experience. This has been done many times before. Edith Wharton did the same thing, and so did Henry Adams, to name but two. I mean, there are many others.
Your great-grandfather co-founded Texaco. Now, does that make you new rich or old rich? Does that make your family new or old rich?
Well, it would make my family... Had my grandfather the wit to retain the fortune, which, of course, he did not. He lost. He lost it all. Therefore, I had to start over again. I mean, neither my father nor myself started out life with any real money at all. We had the pretensions and the illusions of a fortune, but we didn't have the wherewithal to maintain the illusion. Had my grandfather retained the fortune, I certainly would be old rich. I mean, to have made a fortune to be the heir of a fortune earned in the late 19th century would qualify me as definitely an old rich sort of person.
So you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up, but you had the...
You had the aura of it. You know, the family used to sit around and tell these great stories about great-grandfather, right? And my grandfather, of course, was still alive, and he did have a considerable amount of money, which he spent as fast as he could.
But your family still had power. Your grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco.
Yeah. No, there was a shipping company, and my grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco, and after that went to... China with the Marshall Plan and then to Greece. So, yes, no, the family was walking around on the upper floors of San Francisco society. That's true.
You wrote that when you were a child, you frequently rode in limousines in public ceremonies, and you thought that you were born to ride in triumph and others were born to stand on the street and wave and smile. Was that kind of feeling encouraged?
No, it was very, I mean, you remember at the time I was 10 years old, my grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco during World War II, and therefore there were during the war there was a great deal of ceremony attached to being the mayor and presiding over the departure of troops and aircraft carriers into the Pacific, and it was a time when people did stand in the streets, and it was a time when people did carry a great many flags and so forth and so on. So you can imagine it from the point of view of a little boy, 10 years old, riding with his grandfather to the Kezar Stadium to review a battalion of troops or something. The kid could get quite confused.
You went to Hotchkiss and to Yale, to very prestigious, very expensive schools. And they're schools where it's assumed if you're there, you come from money. Now, you were telling us that your family had the aura of money at this point, but they didn't have that much actual money. Is this something that your friends knew about you? Was this something of a dirty secret for you?
No, you mean at Hotchkiss in Yale?
Yeah.
No, because everybody was in the same, more or less. I'm sorry, maybe I missed the question, but the point is that everybody at those schools was in more or less the same boat.
No, but you were saying that you didn't have as much money as it seemed.
Oh no, I don't mean to say I was impoverished. I mean the family was not what you would call big rich. It would be what you would call in, you know, comfortable circumstances. But the family had enough to send me to educate me. It didn't have enough to buy lots of houses and boats and all of those sorts of things. But, I mean, it had enough to get me through school.
Did you try on a lot of different personalities while you were in college and away from your family?
Try on a lot of different personalities?
Yeah.
Including
being poor or bohemian.
Oh, yeah, I tried on bohemian. And because bohemian in those days, we're now talking about the 50s, and that was supposed to be the, if one wanted to be a writer in those days, one was, you know, it was assumed that one would be a bohemian of some sort. It was an earlier variation of what the later became the counterculture style of the 60s. It's a matter of most people in college try on different parts.
Did your family ever give you guidelines on dealing with inherited money, how to spend it?
There wasn't any, so there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
there was no need for a handbook.
I'd like to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the subject of your new book, which is titled Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. My guest is Lewis Lapham, and he's the editor of Harper's Magazine. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lewis Lapham is my guest, the editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of the new book, Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. Can I ask you why you wanted to go into newspaper reporting, which was how you started your profession, through your professional career?
Well, I started out thinking I wanted to be an historian, and then didn't quite have the fortitude to make it through an American graduate school. This is kind of terrible place to be, and I like to write, and I had a romantic notion of the newspaper business in the 50s. That was the way one, it was a kind of an apprenticeship, it was the way one learned how to write. I mean, all of the important American writers of the 20s and 30s, people like O'Hara and Steinbeck and James M. Cain and so forth, Hemingway, had all started as newspaper reporters, and that was the way one learned the trade.
But you got out of that and switched to magazine writing.
Yeah, I switched to magazine writing because that was, again, I have a very much of an apprentice, long-term notion of learning how to write. So once you learn how to write the newspaper article, then you graduate up and learn to write the magazine piece, which is a longer form and a different sets of conventions.
Well, you're editing a magazine now, have been for years. Do you think that magazines have been changed by television?
Sure. I mean, when I first started writing in 1962 for the Saturday Evening Post, the Saturday Evening Post was like the television networks now. There's a direct analog. The large general interest magazine, Saturday Evening Post, Life, fulfill the function that the television networks now fill, so that magazine writing has changed a great deal. I mean, it's had to become much more specific and much more narrowly defined than it used to be. I mean, the large general interest magazine, it really no longer exists.
A lot of magazines, and I think including your magazine, Harper's, have gone to shorter stories than they once carried. Do you think that shorter stories are a function of shorter attention spans of readers, or Do you think it's just that readers are busier and have less time to spend reading long stories?
I think that it's more the latter. I mean, it's not that they have shorter attention spans. Actually, they're more sophisticated, so that they will look most long. They haven't got a lot of time to waste on writing that is padded, or writing that or ideas with which they're already familiar. I mean, so what we do is it's the form is more concentrated. For people who do read a lot of other things, there are some long things that are worth reading. Not many, but some. Most nonfiction books are really an article inflated to the size that it can be sold at $18.95. I mean, most magazine articles, most long ones, can be reduced easily by more than half. And the intelligent reader doesn't have the patience to work his or her way through the dross.
You know, an interesting issue pertaining to magazines that I think also pertains to money and class in America is demographics. The way I understand it, magazines are much more demographically oriented than they used to be. And I've actually heard of magazines who limit their subscribers. They actually cut some subscribers out because their subscribers' demographics aren't that good. They don't make enough money. And the magazine wants to be able to tell its advertisers that, you know, 90% of its readers make in the $50,000 and above category or whatever.
Yeah, that's done all the time. And you begin to see it being done on television, too, pretty soon. They'll finally figure it out. But a magazine is sold not... The magazine is a bit of a contradiction because it's the business of a magazine is the same as the business of a billboard. It has nothing to do with the content. I mean, the way the magazine makes money is by delivering to an advertiser a space and a certain kind of audience or reader. And so that they increasingly, as the magazine business multiplies and proliferates, it tries to deliver to its advertiser only the most expensive readers. I mean, there are some companies, I think there's an insurance company called Chubb, that will only advertise in magazines that can prove that their average reader has a net worth of $500,000. So that because that's the kind of person to whom Chubb can sell its fancier financial services.
The ironic thing is, though, like say you have like 10,000 readers who have $1 million. What's the harm if like 10,000 other people read the magazine too and are subscribers, but they make a lot less? I mean, but the magazine wouldn't necessarily want them on the subscription rolls because it brings down the demographics.
Certainly. That's right. They cut them off. I mean, they're like people. It's the same attitude as you try to get, you know, you try to keep impoverished people out of your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them cluttering up the sidewalks and going to the schools.
That at your magazine?
No, we do not, because our magazine is sold on the basis of its, not on its demographics, but on its ideas. And that's why we have such a wonderful audience, because it's got a mixture of rich people, poor people, and so forth. The thing that holds them together is their curiosity of mind and their level of education.
You know, you are in...
But it's a small magazine, you understand. I mean, you couldn't do that if you had an enormous magazine, probably.
You are in a position of editorial power, and I'm sure many, many writers have passed through your office, new emerging writers trying to make an impression on you. Have people tried to impress you by dressing certain ways and by indicating that they are a part of a class that they're really not, whether it's an artistic class or a financial class? It seems to me you are very astute. You're very aware of the signals that people use to try to communicate class and bearing, and you'd be able to see through a lot of this.
It doesn't happen that much. I mean, it's a kind of a small... magazine, and there's not a lot of money to be made in these days in magazine writing. And so maybe if I were a person that was hiring scriptwriters for television series, that might happen to me. But almost all my decisions always are made from what's on the paper. somebody calls me up and says, I want to come and see you. And I said, well, look, just send me the manuscript and I'll read it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, the stakes in my end of the magazine business are really quite low.
You were explaining to us before that by the time you came of age, there really wasn't any money left to inherit in the family, although the family used to have a lot of money. And I wonder why you have remained so obsessed with issues pertaining to class and money.
Well, I've become obsessed with it because the society is obsessed with it, I think. The shaping of an attitude towards it is, after all, what American politics is all about. It is what the city of New York is about. It's increasingly what Washington is all about. It is the subject of the national conversation. And people don't, you know, if you get people in a room and somebody over in one corner starts talking about Marx or Flaubert and somebody in another corner is talking about an existential idea, these two conversations cease the moment somebody else comes in the room and starts talking about a magnificent real estate deal, you see. I mean, it is the subject of it is what the country talks about and thinks about. And if you look at the newspapers in any one day, the front page of the Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer or the, you know, Miami Herald, that's the subject. It's not my obsession. It's not my obsession alone. I mean, it is as if I'm some sort of recluse in a garret thinking about this subject. It's, you know, look at the proliferation of the business magazines. You know, people, or the constant conversation about the drug deals. Look at the stuff that's on television. Dynasty, Dallas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you like to watch those shows?
No.
Just to keep up with what's happening?
Well, occasionally, sure. But I mean, so I know what people are talking about, but it's not something that I would otherwise look at.
Tell me, we're speaking long distance. You're in a New York studio. I'm in a Philadelphia studio. If I were to see you now and see how you're dressed, how you're seated in your chair, would I know that you came from a wealthy family? I mean, do you still feel like that you have that kind of aura about you, that kind of presence?
I don't think you could tell that I was from a wealthy family. I think you could tell that I'd been to an Ivy League school.
How would I know that?
Well, I'm wearing a gray suit.
Oh, okay.
A rather conservative tie.
Now, do you want people to know that? Is that just, I mean, is that a signal you still want to give, or is that just what you're used to shopping for?
Well, I'm not Tom Wolfe, if that's what
right.
you mean. I mean, I'm not trying to create the image of a dandy or a person of a certain net worth. No, I don't dress that way. I've never thought it's that important.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right.
My guest has been Louis Lapham. He's the editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of the new book, Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Joan Chen. She appears in the film The Last Emperor as the Emperor Puyi's wife. In her native China, she was one of the country's leading film stars. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, part two of our interview with the director who got bored with shocking his audience. John Waters' new film, Hairspray, is an homage to the bouffant hairdos and the teen dance shows of the early 60s. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Little Willie John. He started in gospel, sang jazz for a while, but his most lasting fame came from his R&B hit, Fever. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Trial of Socrates by journalist and social critic I.F. Stone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Presidential political strategists today turned their full attention to New Hampshire, now that the results are in from the Iowa caucuses. But the impact of last night's results has not been fully absorbed, particularly the surprise second-place finish of former TV evangelist Pat Robertson ahead of Vice President George Bush. NPR's Cokie Roberts has details.
George Bush took the worst blow here, though the so-called back-of-the-pack candidates such as Alexander Haig and Bruce Babbitt are now effectively out of the running. The best they could have expected from Iowa was a miraculous upset. George Bush, the Republican front-runner, hoped to at least place a respectable second in this state, which he won in 1980. But the sitting vice president was unable to garner even 20% of the Republican vote. Kansas Senator Robert Dole, with the help of evangelist Pat Robertson, dealt Bush such a defeat that he will almost certainly have to win well in New Hampshire to convince the rest of the country that he's an electable candidate. On the Democratic side, Richard Gephardt's narrow victory gives him a boost going into New Hampshire, but with three candidates bunched at the top and more waiting in the South, the Iowa results have a less dramatic impact on the Democrats than on the Republicans. I'm Cokie Roberts in Des Moines.
The United States government today reacted positively to the Soviet Union's proposal to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan. But a State Department spokesman said the U.S. would have to wait and see what the Soviets actually do to get out of Afghanistan. The Soviets said that if a peace agreement can be settled by March 15th, their troops would be gone within 10 months of that date. A United Nations mediator who has been helping Pakistan and Afghanistan reach a peace settlement said that the two sides have virtually agreed on a timetable for troop removal. There is a tense standoff in the Nicaraguan town of Masaya today between Sandinista police and several hundred mothers of military draftees. Last night, an anti-draft demonstration in Masaya turned violent as demonstrators stoned police headquarters and burned two government vehicles. More from NPR's Tom Gelton.
The trouble in Masaya started yesterday after military police began rounding up young men to draft them into the army. Some were evidently taken by force. One woman said boys as young as 13 were grabbed in the roundup. A group of angry mothers then marched on the headquarters of the Sandinista police and a Sandinista youth association, allegedly throwing rocks. The demonstrators turned two government vehicles over and burned them before a pro-Sandinista counter-demonstration was organized and police arrived to quell the disturbance. Mothers were back in the streets of Masaya today, but a large number of Sandinista police kept the order. Masaya is a town about 20 miles southeast of Managua. It was the scene of a bloody uprising against the Somoza dictatorship in 1978. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega's brother Camilo was killed in the Masaya uprising, and the town has since acquired a special place in the history of the Sandinista Revolution. In Managua, Nicaragua, I'm Tom Gelton.
The White House today flatly rejected General Manuel Noriega's demand that the U.S. pull its troops out of Panama. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that under the Panama Canal treaties, the U.S. has every right to have a military presence in Panama. Noriega, who is the country's military leader, was indicted in Florida last week on drug trafficking charges. Today, in hearings on Capitol Hill, an exiled Panamanian political leader accused Noriega of having built a vast personal fortune through an empire of criminal and commercial enterprises. And in Panama today, the government shut down one of the country's largest radio networks after it broadcast interviews calling for Noriega's removal. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 18 points, closing at 1914.46. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of a rhythm and blues singer whose talents were on a par with the likes of Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson. Even James Brown said he wished he could sing like Little Willie John.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
There are some artists whose names people forget almost immediately after their hits stop coming. Historians overlook them, and it isn't until years later that somebody finds a record, puts it on, and realizes that here is a major talent. That's the way it went for Little Willie John. He was born in Arkansas in 1937, and his real name was William Woods. From the sound of his voice, I'd venture to say that he spent some time singing in church, in gospel groups, probably standing in front of the other singers so people could see him. He checked in at exactly 5 feet tall. In 1951, he showed up in Detroit, where the legendary bandleader and talent scout Johnny Otis saw him perform. He recommended that the equally legendary owner of King Records, Sid Nathan, sign him. Nathan passed on the 14-year-old singer, though, at least for a while. Willie John spent the next few years singing with big bands, including those of Count Basie and Duke Ellington, and this meant that he learned a whole lot of the standard repertoire. But his first love was rhythm and blues, and when Sid Nathan gave him his chance in 1955, he was ready with a song by Titus Turner called All Around the World that has some of the finest surrealistic lyrics in the history of rock and roll.
Well, if I don't love you, baby, grits ain't groceries, eggs ain't poultry, and Mona Lisa was a man. All around the world, I'd rather be a fly. I light on my baby and stay with her till I die. With a toothpick in my hand, I dig a 10-foot ditch and run through the jungle fighting lions with a switch. Of course, you know I love you, baby. Yes, you know I love you, baby. Well, if I don't love you, baby, grits and groceries, eggs and poultry, and Mona Lisa was a man.
It was a hit, at least on the rhythm and blues charts, and he followed it up with an even bluesier ballad, I Need Your Love So Bad.
I need someone's hand to lead me through the night. I need someone's arms to hold and squeeze me tight. When the night begins and until it ends, I need your love so bad. I need some lips to feel next to mine. I need someone to stand up and tell me when I'm lying. And when the lights are low and it's time to go, I need your love so bad.
That guitar intro, by the way, was by Mickey Baker, another unsung genius. In the middle of 1956, Willie John had his biggest hit, a song he co-wrote.
Listen to me, baby.
Peggy Lee, of course, is the one who made Fever into a national hit in a version that took all of the subtlety away from the song, which made it pretty hot stuff. In fact, Little Willie John only had two pop hits in his entire career, the sensuous ballad Talk to Me, Talk to Me, and an awful overarranged thing called Sleep. That came out in 1960 and was his last big record. Sometime during the 60s, Little Willie John stabbed a man to death in a bar in a fight over a woman. He was sent to prison in Walla Walla, Washington, and it was there that he died in 1968 of pneumonia. He left behind an incredible number of fine recordings, a fact that was noted by his friend James Brown, who recorded a memorial album called Thinking About Little Willie John and a Few Nice Things. At least somebody remembered.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air.
It's Madison time. Hit it. You're looking good. A big, strong mind. When I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back with a big, strong turn and back to the Madison.
If you were a teenager in the early 60s, you might remember this dance, the Madison. You might also remember the mashed potatoes, the twist, and the pony. The dancers in John Waters' new film, Hairspray, had to learn them all. John Waters is the director who said that for him, bad taste is what entertainment is all about. He proved it to us in Pink Flamingos and Polyester. His new film, Hairspray, is set in Baltimore in 1962 at the height of the TV dance show craze. In the movie, all the kids want to dance on the Corny Collins show, but only white teenagers are allowed on. The black teenagers are ready to protest. Waters describes Hairspray as a satire of two dreaded genres, the teen flick and the message movie.
I had a couple movies I wanted to do, and I knew that this one was one obsession I had that was possibly palatable to movie executives. So I thought I'd better go with this one.
How did you pitch it to movie executives?
I got up and did the dances in front of them, for
oh,
one
you're
thing.
Kidding. That's
and
great.
They were so startled that they realized I was serious about it. I played them the music, I got a development deal for it. It was done very conventionally.
Oh, that's not conventional, going and doing the dances.
You've ever been to a pitch session?
Really?
I don't know. You got to sell the movie. You got about 10 minutes.
Do you have a less saleable version in your mind? Like a really
no.
more?
Uh-huh. I didn't calculate this to be, oh, this is going to be more commercial and everything. I thought the subject matter had a chance to be, certainly, but it wasn't certainly. I didn't make a movie I didn't want to make. I didn't cut anything out to go wider or anything like that. It just came out this way. And it was an obsession. I mean, I thought it would be inappropriate to have sex and gore in this because that wasn't part of this whole memory. I think it's still a John Waters movie. But it's PG, which I think is great. I wish it was G because that's the only way left that people are surprised. And all my films have been based on surprise.
Did you test market the movie?
Yeah.
So how did you do it?
Well, I had never been through this before. And it's a good experience. It's like testing a Broadway show out of town.
Mm-hmm.
You show the first rough cut Well, that's shown to the exhibitors. Then you show the next cut to a test screening. It's really scary. I mean, I think it was the most anxiety-provoking night of my life because they go out and get what they call a normal audience to come in and see it. And it's like being on trial. You sit there and you pray you don't have to appeal the verdict when you read them all. And luckily, what they said, parts they thought were too slow or there was too much of, were the same notes we had when we finished after watching it with an audience. So all they did was tell us what we knew already.
Where did you go to shopping malls to find
people?
They
do it. That's the people in the San Fernando Valley in L.A. are the most influential people in the country, more than critics, more than the press or anything, because that's where they test every movie when they want to know, what's Mid-America going to think of this?
What were you most interested in checking their response
about? If they laughed. And when I heard the first laugh that should have gotten one in the movie, I can't tell you the tension that was over with in my body. Because you don't know. By then, you've seen it with your editors every day for 3 months. You begin to lose sight of what's funny.
There are some regulars, people who have worked with you in many of your movies, who are featured in your new movie. Divine is in it. Ming Stoll is in it. But there are some new people who've never been in your movies before, like Tracy,
the lead. We have Tracy, who's Ricky Lake. Well, certainly Debbie Harry, who I'd worked with a little bit. She wrote part of the music for Polyester. Jerry Stiller, who plays Divine's husband. Sonny Bono, who plays sort of the villain in it.
Why were you so anxious to cast Sonny Bono?
I always just like Sonny Bono. I mean, you never say, no casting agent says, get me a Sonny Bono type. There's only one Sonny Bono. And that's what I like, is actors that they're unique. And everybody knows who Sonny Bono is. I mean, I think he's a real star.
I had some new campaign flyers made up today. All for Daddy's little girl. Now, I want you to hand those out at the hop tonight to everyone, each and every one of those.
Oh, Daddy! No lip from you, Miss Ingrate. This campaign is costing us an arm and a leg.
New gowns? Hairdresser 3 times a week? Why, your hairspray bill alone is enough to eat up all the profits from the tilt-a-whirl.
You'll do as Daddy says, or we'll send you to Catholic school where you belong. Right, Franklin?
That's right.
I bet a lot of real odd characters send you resumes all the time, figuring, like, well, I'm kind of freaky. Waters would really love me.
Yeah, but they're real wrong, because the people that are freaky in real life generally make terrible actors. Good actors, actually, in real life, are shy and very quiet people a lot of the time.
Gee, why do you think that's true?
I don't know. They come alive with a camera. Where people that are always on in real life, as soon as the camera comes on, tend to be very stilted sometimes.
Huh. You cast Divine in a dual role.
Yeah, well, Divine played a man in my other films, too. In Female Trouble, he was a dual role. But in this, he plays, like, I think, kind of a lovable mom. Edna Turnblad. And then he also plays an evil station manager who won't let blacks on the show. And we wanted to make him totally unrecognizable. We had new teeth made for him.
No kidding.
I mean, so that he even talks to, his face is shaped differently and talks differently because all the teeth are fake. So I liked him. I thought he looked like sort of scary almost as a man.
Oh,
it's his male impersonation.
Divine makes such a sympathetic housewife.
Yeah, and I don't think, I think I'm, it's really, so far I've been very encouraging that both the Variety Review and the Hollywood Reporter Review have talked a lot about Divine and never mentioned that he was a man. It didn't matter anymore that Divine's a man, which I think is good because he's not a transvestite. He doesn't wear those clothes when he's not making a movie. You can't even call him a drag queen. What self-respecting drag queen would allow themselves to look as hideous as he looks in the beginning of Hairspray? So he's basically a character actor.
What about the woman who played Divine's daughter in the movie? Was she aware of the fact that her mother was going to be played by a man? How did she react
to that?
Well,
how it happened was when she got the part, she didn't know who I was or about the films, but her mother did and said, oh, you're playing Divine's daughter? It's great. Because I was looking for a baby Divine, basically. And they got along fine, you know. I mean, Divine would coach her sometimes with lines like, I'm in love, and I'm big, blonde, and beautiful. Divine said, oh, I've been saying those lines for years. Give it some oomph here. So he was sort of like, gave some good coaching to her.
There are a lot of teenagers in the movie. Were they familiar with your early work? Did you want them
to
see those
movies? No, I didn't
movies?
Want them to see them, and I discouraged them from seeing them. I actually just talked to two of them who just rented them all this week and saw it, and they liked them. But that's because they got comfortable with us, and they knew everybody, and by the end, I think if they had seen those beginning films in the very beginning before we shot, it might have frightened some of them.
Might have changed their acting performance, too. They might have thought that you wanted something
more hateful or more over the top.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You wrote the movie as well as directed it and co-produced it. So the actors were saying your lines. How do you feel about actors improvising on your lines?
I generally don't like it because I shoot the exact script and it screws up people's timing if somebody throws in a line and they don't know the next one's coming. If we do any improvisation, we do it in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
When we realize that there's a dead point where somebody has to walk across the room and there's just dead silence. We'll work that out in improv. Or when we do it the run through before we do the take. But mostly I give producers the script that I turn in. I film exactly that.
What about the look of the movie? What kind of look do you feel you were going for?
I was going for like a 62 garish color kind of movie, like a Elvis Presley movie or a Parent Trap look.
Oh, yeah.
And my cinematographer, Dave Inslee, knows pretty much what I want. I've worked with him for years. And I think certainly Vince Perrineo has done all my sets since Multiple Maniacs. Really knows that period, really knows how to make it look exactly the way I want it. Same with Van Smith, who did all the costumes. He knows the look. He knows what I want. I don't even have to tell them anymore.
You shot the movie on location in Baltimore. There was a time in your early film career when you'd have to shoot on the sly and run from the police.
Yeah. We did that once on one shot because this time we dealt with the city and we dealt with the state and we had permits, we had police closing the streets and everything, which was amazing to me still that you could take over a neighborhood and everybody just says, okay. I mean, the police would wake up people at 5 in the morning and say, you have to move your car, they're making a movie, and people wouldn't give a peep of not wanting to do it, which amazed me. But one day, we had to get a shot, and they told us we couldn't block the street off because it was rush hour. And we just went and did it anyway, and it was really fun, that hit and run. I hadn't done that in so long. It was just one little shot we had to get. We jumped out of the car, we set up real quick, and before anything could happen, we got it and ran. But it was a great feeling.
This is your first movie in a long time, around 7 or 8 years. Are you going to be making more movies now?
I hope so. If this one's a hit, I will. I'll be able to make one much quicker. If it's not, it'll take longer. It's just economics here in America.
Okay, John Waters, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
John Waters' new film, Hairspray, opens nationally on February 26th. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we have a number of stories tonight on last night's Iowa caucuses. Analysis on the meaning of Republican Pat Robertson's unexpectedly strong showing. He came in second place last night in what both Republicans and Democrats will be trying for in next week's New Hampshire primary. Also, rock and roll voter registration. Frank Zappa is trying to convince his fans to sign up and get out and vote. We also have a report on a plan by the Justice Department to raid video stores that carry pornographic videos.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Greek philosopher Socrates poisoned himself in 399 BC after having been condemned to death for the crimes of impiety and the corruption of youth. His student Plato wrote about him, and now journalist I.F. Stone has written a book examining the fate of Socrates and the society he would not appease. Critic John Leonard has this review.
For more than 20 years, I.F. Stone, maverick journalist and left-wing gadfly, published his own newspaper, I.F. Stone's Weekly, covering the stories everybody else seemed to miss. A decade ago, his eyesight failing, he turned his attention back in time, anxious to figure out why his favorite democracy, 4th century BC Athens, had convicted Socrates for crimes against the city-state and sentenced him to death. To prepare for this immensely entertaining book, he reread in the original Greek Plato and everybody else who was anybody in antiquity, as well as every lexicon and commentary he could look at through his famous magnifying glass. And it's as if he were reporting on the trial for his old skeptical weekly. What happens is that Stone, a Jeffersonian Democrat, gets to know Socrates, the philosopher who would be king, and doesn't like him. Socrates, and I'm quoting bits and pieces from throughout Stone's book, was evasive, ridiculous, a town character on an ego trip, full of arid semantics, immeasurable conceit, and class prejudice, with no interest in the rights of the poor or social justice, no compassion for the common people, a bad citizen who never shed a tear for Athens, idealized Sparta, and despised democracy. He was also a lousy husband. None of this, of course, is punishable by death. But democratic Athens had reason to be nervous. There had been two bloody dictatorships plus a near miss in the 12 years previous to the trial. One of those dictatorships had been run by the best and brightest of Socratic students, Critias, who murdered 1,500 Athenians in 8 months. Aristocratic pro-Sparta thugs roamed the streets, egged on by the pro-Sparta philosopher of a negative dialectic. Even so, Socrates could have beat the rap if he hadn't insulted his jury, or if he had made himself a free speech issue and played to the Athenian love of paradox by delivering a speech Stone writes for him, a wonderful Clarence Darrow-like challenge to the assembly to be true to their principles instead of his. And he needn't have died if he hadn't sneered at the sentencing, or if he'd gone with Plato into exile. Still, Stone's ashamed of Athens. For a Jeffersonian Democrat, Athens is the city on the hill. We read history, like anthropology, hoping to see ourselves, and are often shocked at the face of the other. Looking back, Stone wants to see a sort of New England town meeting, which is unreasonable. It's also worth remembering that Socrates, while a pain, belonged to a long line of philosophers who gnawed their way to the end of what they knew and then had questions about how and if they really knew it. Worried about essentials, they tended to lose touch. A surprising number of them were politically reactionary, like the modernists of our own culture, who likewise thought their way to the end of art and then turned to tear at that art with their teeth. We consult them not for advice, but to hear some dark chords. Stone's heard enough. His century, the 20th AD, deafens us with its contempt for the citizen. Child of the Enlightenment, true believer in democracy, suspicious of official wisdom, he's one of those American originals for whom every idea and all politics have a moral duty to be practical. It's fine to see him in such fighting form.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed The Trial of Socrates by I.F. Stone. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with actor Carl Weathers. After playing boxer Apollo Creed in 4 Rocky films, Weathers is back as the star of the new action film Action Jackson. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new recording of Seiji Ozawa leading the Boston Symphony Orchestra in music of Gabriel Fauré. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss talking computers and how they handle the subtleties of vocal inflection. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write us, if you can, with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.